even stop to think about the babies or how they would survive. And we've almost lost Detroit this time.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Late Gil Scott Heron's tune, We Almost Lost Detroit. That's a song in my memory today. Maybe it's kind of come true. We'll have some thoughts in a moment about Detroit in this program. Also, we'll have a trip into space, courtesy of some theatrically talented real scientists. We'll find out how gold is forged out in space. Bill Richardson will speak to us on the fate of Kenneth Bay, detained American in North Korea, and how sloppy science may have compromised some federal criminal cases. But first, they used to make cars in Detroit. They still do, but today Detroit is perhaps more famous for producing turnips, dry financial turnips. Bloodless, dry turnips with no financial angels on the horizon, Detroit succumbed to the inevitable yesterday and entered into the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Chapter 9, $18 billion in debt, at least. Declining revenue, declining population for many years, increasing joblessness. The move made late Thursday afternoon, and the move was promptly accepted by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder in Lansing.
From a financial point of view, let me be blunt. Detroit's broke. It's been spending 38 cents on the dollar towards legacy costs. That number was projected to grow to 65 cents on the dollar. That's not a sustainable situation.
Not sustainable while 40% of the city's streetlights do not work. More than half of the parks have closed since 2008. Unsustainable. This city started to close down a long time ago.
More important than the financial situation are the poor services that are being delivered to the citizens of Detroit. They simply deserve better.
For instance, they might deserve an answer promptly when they call 911.
If you look at it in terms of public safety, Detroit has been on the top 10 list of the most violent cities in 24 of the last 27 years. Response times for police calls are at 58 minutes versus a national average of 11 minutes.
Those are just some of the details as Detroit tries to figure out what the implications of a Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing are. We're joined by Craig Folly, the host of the Craig Folly Show on WDET in Detroit. Craig, welcome. It's a sad day. How are you feeling today?
John, that's tough. Sad? I don't know if that's the right word. You pointed out some really, really important facts just a moment ago, that this city has been declining for a long, long time. Fact is, a lot of people here are looking at this, not to say that they're happy about it, but at least somebody's trying to get a handle on the situation and maybe correct some of the mistakes that have been plaguing this city for the last several decades.
So it's like a party where everybody's wearing a costume and in denial about the finances and the reality in Detroit has finally come to an end. People take off the costumes and there's a relief about seeing things the way they really are.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that the pensioners are necessarily relieved or retirees are going to be relieved about what's going on. But if you're a city resident, not somebody who's worked for the city, but somebody who just lives here, and all of a sudden you see more of the revenue that the city gets that is being directed towards services, garbage pickup, police, streetlights that actually work, that's not something that a lot of people are going to be upset about. And it's something that needs to be addressed in some capacity. And barring some sort of, you know, divine intervention here, this is about the only way to make it happen. A lot of people have been talking about this for years now, and it's just come to fruition at this point.
Does the state of Michigan have an interest here, or is this more a federal-state partnership kind of issue to deal with a federal problem, which, while confined to Detroit, is certainly not only relevant to this city?
Oh, I think the state has a significant interest here. One of the things the governor has been saying since he was elected to this office a few years ago is that, you know, without a healthy Detroit, there will never be a fully healthy Michigan. So taking these steps as drastic as they are, and he's taken a lot of criticism for even getting Detroit to this point where an emergency manager's in place to file bankruptcy here in the city of Detroit. I mean, I think what he's looking at is 20 years from now, when we look back on all of this, people are going to say, well, somebody stepped up. It was unpopular at the time, but it had to get done. The federal government, we haven't heard a whole lot from, other than the White House suggesting that they're monitoring the situation. So I think it's definitely going to be a sort of a state-city partnership more than anything else at this point.
As someone who lived in Michigan for a little while on the other side of the state, it always seemed to me that part of Detroit's difficulty is the extent to which there's a real separation and a non-sharing of resources among some of the very prosperous communities there near Detroit, Bloomfield Hills, Birmingham, Grosse Pointe, those kinds of communities there. And that the more natural partnership would be with all of them, a more consolidation, a metropolitanization of Detroit, rather than a partnership with Lansing that's, about an hour and a half drive away.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not that easy, though, because this goes back to territorial days here. The way that the township system was set up in Michigan, it's very difficult to take away home rule from communities that have it right now. And the politics around this are significant. There is a huge resistance to the idea of anybody paying extra money to help the city of Detroit if there's not the perception that they're helping themselves. This could be that sort of turning point, that Detroit finally looked inward and recognized that its system was unsustainable. People may be more willing to cooperate on some regional issues if they get a feeling that their tax money isn't going to be just wasted. And that's been the big problem politically.
And Craig Folley of the Craig Folley Show on WDET in Detroit. You know, Detroiters have seen this before. Lee Iacocca took Chrysler into bankruptcy and roared back and was a national hero. I mean, it's a little different in terms of economics, but this has happened before. There could be somebody who really comes roaring back here.
Well, you know, there's a lot of investment that is actually happening in certain parts of the community right now. And that's been happening despite, of course, the turmoil swirling around when it comes to the finances in the city of Detroit. So there is hope that if something can be done to halt the decline here, that if you can at least stop the decline, that you might be able to begin building again. But for a lot of these neighborhoods, that is going to be a long and difficult road back if it comes back at all. And that's going to be the big disconnect here, is whether or not the comeback only benefits some and not the people that have been suffering the most under Detroit's current plight.
Finally, Mayor Bing's health problems, the terrible corruption problems with Kwame Kilpatrick now serving prison time. Who's given up on Detroit?
That's an interesting question. I think the people who live here still have not given up on this place. They would like to see it survive. There's a lot of fighting that's still going on, arguing as to whether or not others have given up on the city, and that's why they're trying to dismantle it in some capacity. But, you know, some of the suburbanites around here gave up on it a long time ago. They're not going to come back, but the young people have not. They're coming back, and I have a feeling that Detroit could do something differently in the future. It's not going to be the same story it is right now.
And that's pretty positive.
I think it is positive. Look, I'm still here. I'm here for a reason. And I think there's a lot of people just like me that are here for a reason because they see the real possibility of something significant and important here.
Don't go changing, Craig Folley.
Thanks, John.
Craig Folley, host of the Craig Folley Show on WDET. The city became the largest municipal Chapter 9 bankruptcy in U.S. history. Thanks, Craig.
Thank you.
Communities all around the world are being forced to consider mechanisms for matching community needs with available resources on their own. Loss of taxable income, valueless property, corruption all drive money out of the reach of government tax collectors as people try to survive on their own in communities now without government control or even a government at all. Every community from Congo and Somalia in Africa with no functioning government to other bankrupt U.S. municipalities like Jefferson County, Alabama or Orange County, California back in 1994 faced the same issues. How do you collect resources and then how do you decide what to fund first? In Detroit, there's an example of how to tackle this problem. Soup, it's called. It's a monthly competition where up to 300 Detroiters pay $5 each for soup and a vote to support a local creative project for social change. The winner takes home the pool of entry fees to begin their project. With me now is this month's winner of the soup competition, Amy Peterson. Her project is called Rebel Nell. Welcome, Amy, and congratulations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how robust is a program like this in replacing the kinds of things that are going to be lost from a municipal bankruptcy? Or are you more on the fringe doing little seed money startups?
Well, it's interesting. Most of the competitors that I went up against are doing just that. They're replacing what is typically government subsidized in other towns and counties. So I think that there is a great need for that. You know, some of it is seed money so that we can grow our projects, but I think that they are serving a greater function than just getting seed money.
And they sense some prosperity in Rebel Nell. What's the product?
So what we're doing, it's actually, we're very excited about it. We are making jewelry from repurposed material here in Detroit. We're going to be starting with graffiti. After it falls off the walls, we turn that material into pieces of jewelry. But the objective of our business is to provide a transitional opportunity for disadvantaged women in the shelters, give them an employment opportunity, educate them on life skills, and then empower them to move forward in an independent life.
Now, some might look at that and say what you're doing is kind of cannibalizing the crumbling city that people have been looking at now for a generation. The question is, what will replace those things? What kind of prosperity is going to do a rebuilding that identifies Detroit as something new other than the place where the auto industry went away?
Yeah, I think what we're doing is kind of, you know, I think there's a lot of symbolism with the piece of graffiti and Detroit. You know, on its surface, it looks a little rough, but underneath are all these beautiful layers. And I think it's kind of calling attention to all the beautiful layers of people and ideas and history that make up the city. I think it's the grassroots efforts that are going on here. So many people are rolling up their sleeves and taking their own initiative to help rebuild. And a lot of those rebuilding efforts are ensuring that a positive community impact is a foundation of their business concept. And I think we live in it. We see it every day. So if we can do something to help while also being just conscious entrepreneurs, is a growing movement here.
So I'm sensing in the soup here a mix of fear, a mix of denial, a mix of relief, a mix of disgust. That's a lot swirling around this morning there in Detroit.
Yeah, but then at the same time, you have a Detroit soup who just, you know, Detroiters are really resilient people, and we have dealt with a lot of things throughout our history, and then you move on. And so Detroit Soup last Sunday was a wonderful example of that. It was a huge turnout and people voting and showing hope for the city because they're willing to cast their votes in a positive idea that they think will have a tremendous amount of impact in the city. And the voting was really close, and the other competitors also had great ideas. There's a lot of great positive things going on in the city, despite, you know, the headlines and what else is going on. I think you'll see a lot of concerned citizens who are taking matters into their own hands and really helping to rebuild the community on their own.
Well, Amy, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Amy Peterson is co-founder of Rebel Nell, the winner of this month's Detroit Soup Competition. Later this hour, a trip to the end of the universe, the burgeoning field of space tourism. If you're ready for an extraterrestrial voyage, a listener from Fort Wayne, Indiana says, I'd go anywhere. I'd wanted to be an astronaut since the space program started when I was a child. Unfortunately, women were not accepted at the time. Over on Facebook, David from California says he'd travel to the event horizon at the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. Take a picture, won't you, David? Where would you make your maiden voyage? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Coming up, some dubious science causes a review of FBI labs. That's next on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You may recall in the George Zimmerman case, the prosecution case pivoted on the quality of its witnesses. And questionable witnesses, as the trial went on, raised doubts in the mind of the jury. Well, at the FBI, questions about forensic science are raising similar doubts about evidence in some criminal investigations and even threatening some convictions and guilty verdicts. 27 death penalty convictions are involved in a total of 120 convictions being looked at. In all, more than 21,700 FBI laboratory files are being examined. With us to explain the significance of the review is Peter Neufeld, who's co-director and co-founder of the Innocence Project, which is assisting the FBI and the Department of Justice review of all of this. Peter, welcome.
Thank you. It's much more likely, in fact, that we're talking about a couple of thousand cases, not
really?
Just 127 cases where FBI agents in the 1980s and 1990s provided scientifically invalid testimony.
Now, is this sloppy? Is this deliberately wrong? Is this pressure to bring a conviction? Is it an individual case-by-case sort of thing?
Well, probably, most likely, it's the third category. It seems like there was a lot of pressure put on the agents early on because in Hare, they couldn't provide a statistic on how rare something was. So very often, they would simply say, you know, it must have come from him. It probably came from him. It couldn't have come from anyone else. When, in fact, it's no different than saying the perpetrator was a tall guy with red hair and the defendant is a tall guy with red hair. It could be very, very common. And as we found out in these DNA exoneration cases, we've already exonerated 71 people who were convicted based on hair testimony. But all of a sudden, there were three cases in a row involving FBI agents where people have been convicted of murder. Each one served 20 years. The real perpetrators were free to commit more crimes. And that created quite a to-do.
Is this an indictment of the science behind identifying fiber evidence, hair evidence, and associating it with individual defendants?
It's not an indictment of the science. The science is good. The people just simply weren't comporting with science. They were indifferent to the laws of probabilities and statistics, and they just sort of made that up as they went along. That's what's so serious. What's fabulous about this, though, is that, and the FBI should be congratulated, because these problems did not occur on their watch. These thousands of cases were from the 1970s, 1980s, and 90s. And in the old days, the FBI may have circled the wagons and refused to deal with it. But fortunately now, we have an administration where they really care about these issues. They understand they have a duty to correct errors, and they're moving forward to accept responsibility and do something about it.
Part of this is driven by the fact that DNA science allows for a sort of gold standard of testing where you can go back and look at a criminal conviction, and if the DNA profile matches the other evidence in the case, even if it took place before DNA was used in evidence, you can confirm findings that might have been questionable up until then. Is there suddenly impetus to essentially get a DNA finding on virtually every one of these 71,000 cases and files?
Well, of the 21,000 files that they're looking at, in particular, 2,000 files right now where FBI agents said there was a positive inculpatory association, they would like to try and get DNA testing on them. But quite likely, in the intervening 20 years, a lot of the evidence has been lost or destroyed. The problem is that nevertheless, the original evidence was flawed. It was false evidence. And lawyers are going to have to sort through this. What kind of role did the hair testimony play in the underlying conviction? A lot of these people were on death row. Many of them were executed. I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface of that yet. But we're going to be finding probably dozens of people in this group who were executed where key evidence used against them was hair evidence provided by these FBI agents, which grossly exaggerated the probative value of the evidence, which was simply scientifically invalid.
Within those cases, I mean, it's one thing to say there was dubious evidence for someone on death row and that person was executed. It's another thing to say this decisive piece of evidence, but for this piece of evidence, there would not have been a conviction. An execution was essentially killing an innocent man. How many of those cases do you think are in here? Is it 12? Is it 2? Is it way more than 12?
It's too early to predict, but it depends on a case-by-case basis how critical the hair evidence was to the conviction. So the first step is to determine whether or not the agents gave scientifically invalid testimony, and then in that subset of cases, we have to go back, deconstruct the cases, look at all the testimony, all the witnesses, and see what role hair played.
We really want to give creds to the Washington Post here that was at the beginning of looking at all these dubious forensic scientific practices here. They really opened the can of worms here, right?
Yeah, there was a reporter named Spencer Hsu who actually spent a year doing more than a dozen stories and last year won two journalism awards for it. He was dogged, as you say, and uncovered a lot of this. And in fact, according to the FBI, they give him credit for his disclosures, his exposés, for precipitating their decision to launch this massive review of old cases.
And to their credit, this doesn't look like a Band-Aid. This looks like a systematic look at what seemed to have been a dysfunctional approach to hair evidence.
Oh, no. The FBI really does deserve credit as well here. No one's hiding the ball. They're the ones who are acting in a very proactive fashion. They recognize there's a duty to correct when these errors occur. And they're going to be sending out letters for the first time, not just to prosecutors, but to make it completely transparent to the defendants and defense attorneys as well. And I might add, there's something else about this study that's completely unprecedented and very important going forward for all of criminal justice and in particular capital punishment in America. About 18 years ago, Congress passed a statute saying that we're going to make it much more difficult with statutes of limitation and other kinds of procedural default bars for inmates who had old death penalty cases to bring these challenges. What the Justice Department has decided for this set of cases, we will waive the statute of limitations, we'll waive the procedural defaults. We want these cases decided on the merits. That's how important they see it.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, well, we see it as a sea change.
Wow. Peter Neufeld, co-founder and co-director of the Innocence Project, on a review of FBI lab evidence in hair cases. Thanks so much. We're going to talk about space vacations coming up later this hour, and maybe you want to do some sort of mineral exploration out in space. Well, just to let you know, the really spectacular explosions in the universe involve the creation of black holes, fusion in the center of stars, explosion of gas giants, pulsars, that kind of thing. Those fireworks are spectacular, but they only produce, you know, hydrogen, helium, lead, lots of obscure radioactive isotopes. It's the cooler sky, apparently, that forges more useful metals, iron, silver, platinum, diamond, and gold. New research suggests that all the gold on Earth might have come from the relatively unspectacular collision of cold, dead stars. Ido Berger is Associate Professor of Astronomy at Harvard University. Ido Berger, welcome.
Greetings, John, from Boston, where it's actually hot enough to melt gold.
It is, and down here, I think so, too. We'll try to do that a little bit later today. So is it this sort of clomping into each other of dead stars with the cool matter that forges even heavier elements like gold?
That is correct. What we find in our study is that neutron stars, which are objects that are about the size of New York City, but weigh about 1.5 times the mass of the sun, sometimes collide into each other. And when they do that, they can forge elements such as gold and uranium and platinum.
And if we were to be, you know, flying by these collisions, they would be pretty spectacular enough for us. I mean, they probably would cause our heart to palpitate a little bit, but they're nothing like a fusion explosion or the explosion of a gas star.
They're not as powerful as those kind of explosions, but they still release about as much energy as the sun will in its entire lifetime in a span of about 1 second.
That's big. That's pretty impressive. You definitely want to wear a suit for that. Now, is that to say that if you were cruising around on one of these neutron stars, the availability of gold would be such that it's essentially worthless, something like, aluminum foil in a dump?
To some extent, that is correct. We estimate that in this particular event that we studied, there's about several times the mass of our moon worth of gold that was produced. If you dumped all of that gold on the market in one day, it will make it more or less worthless.
And the gold that exists in the Earth, now that is chunks of neutron star events that may have been floating out in the universe and kind of gathered together as the solar system was formed, that kind of thing? Or is it something about the solar system that involved a neutron star collision?
No, I think it is essentially neutron star collisions that happened in the Milky Way galaxy well before the solar system actually formed, that enriched the gas in the Milky Way with flecks of gold and platinum and uranium. And eventually, this is the material from which the solar system itself formed, that the Earth formed from. And this is how we got our gold.
And gold is, you know, one of those elements that it doesn't really change much. It's very pure, and that's why we value it, and that's why we have all this mythology about it. So the gold we're looking at, even in the jewelry store, is very much the same as how it looked billions of years ago.
That is exactly correct. So when people walk around with a wedding ring or earrings, they're actually walking around with pieces of neutron stars that collided billions of years ago.
That might push the price up a little bit if you could put it into a sales pitch there, Ido.
Yeah, we will work on that.
All right. Ido Berger is Associate Professor of Astronomy at Harvard University. Source of gold in the world, neutron star collisions. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
I'm freaking out, man.
If you blow chunks and she comes back, she's yours.
El Deuterino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
I heard Jeff Bridges in there, which means it's time for movies here with Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer. Rafer, of course, film critic for Newsday. Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. They both do the Movie Date podcast. You can subscribe at moviedatepodcast.org. So I heard Jeff Bridges there. He's in a movie that's coming out, RIPD, Police Officers from the Afterlife Who Chase Down Ghosts of Bad Guys. It's like Ghost meets Starsky and Hutch. Let's listen to a clip.
Look at the ankles on that girl.
That's what you're into, ankles. That's what does it for you?
In my day, women, they dress very conservatively.
That makes you way less creepy.
When exactly was your day?
1800, buddy.
Is he reprising True Grit there? This one looks pretty stinky.
Yeah, he's reprising True Grit and Crazy Heart together together in one role. I think this movie was screened for critics only last night. It's kind of seems to be guaranteed to become a bomb. I have to say, I thought it was kind of funny. It's a little bit like Ghostbusters and Men in Black. Jeff Bridges, pretty charming. He just about saves the movie. Not actually terrible.
John, I have to agree with you that it is like Ghost. It's just like Ghost. You have a couple in love, you have a betrayal, you have somebody dead, you have justice that's trying to be done from beyond the grave. And I watched it with that viewpoint in mind, and I loved it. I laughed and laughed and laughed, and I just thought it was good fun, and the action sequences were really great, too.
So it's a Ghost where you laugh in the end, not cry in the end.
That's right.
All right. That's good. All right. Here we go. We've got this movie called Turbo. Now, I want to know about this. It's first got Samuel Jackson in it. Is this animated?
Yes, animated. Computer animated.
Yeah. And is it really about snails?
It's about a snail who becomes a race car driver. Do you get it? Because snails are slow and race cars are fast. You got that?
I'm getting it. Let's hear a clip.
Are you crazy? Ow!
Yeah, I'm crazy. What made you think I was sane?
I don't know how to. Ow!
Are you a car?
No.
Are you a car?
No.
Then stop driving like one.
Snakes on a plane, snails in a car. Samuel Jackson, the man's a genius. Kristen,
this is one of the worst movies I have ever seen. Not just one of the worst children's movies, but worst. Period. This is one of the worst, boringest, just insufferable long movies I've ever sat through in my whole life. And as Rafer was pointing out, the premise, it's supposed to be so clever, but it's not, and it's so awful.
Aren't the snails look kind of cute, though, the way they animated them?
No, not cute at all.
Not even cute at all.
Not even a little bit cute.
That's Ryan Reynolds also, who's also an RIPD. He plays Turbo. I think the movie gets off to a slow start, ha-ha. But it won me over. I actually liked it in the end. I thought it had a heart. It's got a good message about dreams and overcoming your limitations. And ultimately, I kind of liked it.
Started out as snails, ended up as escargot.
That's right.
Wow, look at that. All right, The Conjuring. This is a horror movie. It's got a great indie cast. It's sort of a hipster gathering of death and horror. Listen.
All right, it's 9:18. We're headed down into the cellar where the door's just opened on its own. You give us a sign that you want to communicate with us.
This kind of Blair Witchy thing. What's going on here, Rafer?
Well, this is sort of Blair Witch, Paranormal Activity, Exorcist, The Birds, pretty much every horror film from the last, I'd say, 50 years. Just everything except Cat People, maybe. But, great cast. The director, James Wan, who did Saw, does a pretty good job here. It's pretty smart, pretty clever, and I overlooked all the cliches and had a pretty good time with it.
Did you get scared,
Kristen? I got too scared. Really? I thought it was a little too scary, but I totally enjoyed it. The one movie you guys didn't mention was Amityville Horror. It's very reminiscent of Amityville Horror, and it's actually based on a true story, supposedly. And the ghost hunters in the movie were the ghost hunters who worked on the Amityville Horror case.
And we'll end on a hopeful note here.
You ignored my messages.
I am happy.
You're desperate.
I can make this work.
Frank, you're playing house.
Look, I'm retired, okay? I'm happy. We are happy.
Frank, you haven't killed anybody in months.
You know what? It's not a bad thing, okay? That's a positive thing.
So, John Malkovich and Bruce Willis will never retire, right? Red, too?
That's right. If you liked Red, you'll like this one, and Helen Mirren's pretty good, too.
Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer from the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John.
There's something of a ritual to the relationship between North Korea and the United States, a nuclear dialogue that tries to extract concessions by raising the nuclear stakes or being belligerent with South Korea from time to time. Some provocation, tension rises, settles into a series of concessions for North Korea, narrow concessions, perhaps something as simple as new negotiations. The other game North Korea likes to play involves human pieces.
I mainly work in the farm in this prison. I work from morning to dinner time, 8 hours a day. July 4th is my father's 70th birthday, so I was hoping that my problem will be worked out by the end of June. So my hope is that North Korea will forgive, and the U.S. will try harder to get me out speedily. I'm asking for their help.
North Korean detainee Kenneth Bae speaking there with voiceover translation provided by CNN. Bae is an American citizen. He's been held in North Korea for 6 months already, charged with pursuing hostile acts against the North Korean regime. Bae worked in North Korea as a missionary and tour guide. The regime says he's used his tour guide position to communicate anti-government messages. And in that clip you just heard there, featured on Chosun Sinbo, a pro-North Korean organization based in Tokyo, Bae called on the United States to do more to negotiate his release. These detainee incidents have a ritual to them as well, long stalemates, followed by high-profile dramatic releases, often with a former U.S. president flown in to broker the deal. Former governor of New Mexico Bill Richardson knows this ritual well and has participated in a few prisoner releases in the past. But the new Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, is a wild card so far, Richardson says, not necessarily following the rules of these detentions. Kim Jong-un made much this year of a visit to Pyongyang by NBA star Dennis Rodman. Rodman asked the young North Korean leader to, quote, do him a solid on his Twitter page and release Bae. Does Bill Richardson think that Rodman's tattoo and Twitter diplomacy can actually get Kenneth Bae released?
We're further and farther comprehending what's going on in Pyongyang because, to my knowledge, there's very little dialogue on Kenneth Bae, on getting him out. The relationship with the U.S. is very bad. South Korea, China, I don't believe are ready to make moves to have a dialogue with North Korea. The uncertainty surrounding the new leader of North Korea is such that the normal pattern for some of these cases of Americans detained there is not happening. Usually what happens, there's the individual is tried, sentenced, and then there's a high-profile person, President Carter, Bill Clinton, and then sometimes they send the B team, that's me, and sometimes I get them out. But right now, it seems the North Koreans are not willing to negotiate, and it could be that Kenneth Bae is in a hard labor camp. That's my real concern.
And Dennis Rodman suddenly looks like the C team here. And you see the rituals associated with U.S. detentions and the negotiations for their release really being disrupted here. We're in uncharted waters?
Well, yes. And the fact about Rodman, I know people diminish that, sports star, et cetera. But Rodman got in. He got in to see the new leader. I never got in. Neither did Eric Schmidt at Google. We tried to see him. Rodman sat with him at a basketball game. They seemed to have a rapport. And in this case, I know that that family likes professional basketball. They had once asked me to bring Michael Jordan. You know, I wouldn't know where to find Michael Jordan, but they like Western culture. Maybe he'll do Rodman a favor and give him Kenneth Bae. They have a rapport. The importance is we got to get this guy out. He's an American. He's detained. He's not a spy. He's been there 6 months. He's got a family in Seattle, Washington. And we shouldn't forget these individuals that are detained in foreign jails. We just think of the broad picture of North Korea and the tension. We can't forget our people behind. We can't forget the Kenneth Bays of the world.
Would you say that the stalemate, as you see it in 2013, is it being driven by the uncertainty about Kim Jong-un and his new approach, or is it being driven by the Obama administration dropping the ball?
No, I think it's more the uncertainty of this new leader. I think the Obama administration has responded with restraint. I wish they'd have more openness to dialogue, but when this new North Korean leader detonates a nuclear weapon, shoots missiles, has this very negative rhetoric, shuts down the South Korean, North Korea economic development plan on the border, which employs about 50,000 people. Those are drastic actions. And what I think is happening there is this new young leader is being pushed around and manipulated by hardliners in their government and their political system and the North Korean military. And he's also the young leader acting out. He wants to show that he's tough. So being tough with the U.S., all this rhetoric, I think it's more the uncertainty. I think the Obama administration has handled it relatively well.
You know, the famous story about the Cold War is that the CIA didn't see the fall of the Soviet Union coming. I'm wondering if in any of your experiences in North Korea, you've sensed any kind of breakthrough scenario that would result in the release of Kenneth Bae and detainees like him and change the dynamic forever, that it would fundamentally alter North Korea as being a rogue nation. What's the scenario in your view?
Well, my scenario, unfortunately, is a status quo. There's a cult of personality there. There's the brainwashing of citizens. Unfortunately, when you have a society that doesn't see the outside, the status quo prevails. And when I was in North Korea in January, Eric Schmidt of Google brought his computer there, talked to him about the internet. The North Koreans were enormously excited about that. Eventually, when that internet explodes a bit, and I see that happening, there may be more exchanges of information, but as for a regime change or all these good things happening, like prisoners being released, these gulags ending, I don't see that happening. But I think it's important we have a dialogue. I've always been a believer with countries we disagree with Cuba, with North Korea, we did with Burma. I think it's important that we not demonize, that we not isolate bad actors. We find ways to see if there's any common ground. And by meeting with them and negotiating, you're not necessarily giving up anything.
Former governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson. Governor Richardson, thank you so much.
Thank you. All the best.
On a steamy summer afternoon in Manhattan, no warp drives in this heavy traffic. Just crawling up the West Side Highway. When the energy from our nearest star, the sun, was making the whole day miserable, I found myself looking for a way to blast off and find an alternative to Earth. Now, we're in New York, after all, where you can get anything, so why not a means to blast out of here?
Is there some spaceship around here?
Pardon?
Is there some spaceship around here?
Right over here.
Right over here, what is that?
SS Intrepid.
Intrepid, that's an aircraft carrier.
It's an aircraft carrier.
Is there a spaceship on it?
Yeah, they've got some space shuttle on it or something.
Oh, good, good. Thanks for that. It's right over there. Thanks.
The space shuttle on the USS Intrepid. It can't fly, though. And the one New York City got from NASA was just a test one, which doesn't have any engines. So a toy space shuttle on a dead aircraft carrier isn't going to help us today. There's got to be someone else. How about this couple in the Mercedes convertible?
Guys! Do you guys know about like a travel agency around here that sells tickets to going to space?
Going to space?
Yeah.
No.
It's around here somewhere. You know, it'd really be kind of nice to do that now, right?
You should Google it.
I'll Google it?
You can Google anything.
All right, thanks.
We did Google it, and sure enough, a few blocks from the USS Intrepid and the space shuttle, in the heart of the Garment District on West 37th Street,
down the street from Botani Zippers, a spandex wholesaler, and Diana's Shishi Fashions from Italy is, yes, a travel agency with seats going to the moon and the stars.
Come to the Intergalactic Travel Bureau today. We're learning about space. Let an astronomer plan your next vacation to the stars at the Intergalactic Travel Bureau. Can I interest you in a vacation to outer space? Come inside. It's totally free. Oh, another satisfied customer.
Yep. It's the Intergalactic Travel Bureau, where you can meet Olivia Kosky, a scientist pitching a hard sell for retail space travel.
Our services are always free. We're giving free consultations, free space vacation consultations. Maybe you're sick of Earth. Maybe you'd like to get away for a little while. We can help you envision that experience at the Intergalactic Travel Bureau. Come inside and meet an astronomer, meet an astrophysicist, and plan your next vacation to outer space.
First of all, what do you enjoy in a vacation? Do you like adventurous vacations, relaxing vacations, maybe something romantic?
Sun, fun for the whole family.
Sun and fun for the whole family.
A little romance for me and the husband.
Okay, so first let's talk about our very sunny locales. So we have Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun. So we can send you there. You can do some wonderful low-gravity hiking there. A place that I would recommend, which is very romantic, is Titan. Take a stroll along the shorelines of the Methane Lake. The solar system's premier location for parties is Jupiter.
I haven't even gone to Hawaii yet. I mean, like...
Jana Gersovich is a real postdoctoral student, trying in this more than half-serious way to bring science to the people.
If you want to go to Mars, you're going to be looking upwards of $6 billion. So we take cash, we take check, credit cards, Bitcoin, we do layaway.
A lot of people see space as very separate and very far away. But actually, there are a lot of things that are happening. People are starting to get interested in space exploration, not just for science, but for kind of enjoyment and pleasure.
All three of these women, Olivia Kosky, Dr. Jana Gersovich, and Dr. Renee Hlajek, are dressed and coiffed for success at this spaceport travel agency on West 37th. They call themselves guerrilla scientists, where cosmology meets cosmetology, you might say, in a quest to find the curious out there.
What I like about this is the fact that we can connect to this. Then someone might read an article about SpaceX and go, oh, okay, I now am linking what I saw, and I'm linking that excitement to the real science questions that are being asked. But also it makes them... they're more likely to pick up any article about science and any article about space because they've come here, and that's what I like about doing this.
So you can hear the horns honking. This is a sort of a pop-up store in the middle of the garment district with the air conditioning rattling away like some kind of Rube Goldberg contraption. From a box like this, you can get people on a hot, hot day in Manhattan to be interested in science?
Absolutely. What we're trying to do is engage people who don't normally think about science. And so these would be people walking along the street. If we're staying in museums or universities, we're not engaging the people we really want to. I think it's really important to be where people are and to surprise them and to capture people who don't necessarily have a natural interest in science.
Are some people disappointed who come in here and realize, oh, we can't do this yet?
The fact that they can send a postcard helps a lot with that. But actually...
You thought about that one.
Yeah. One of the things I love most is, and this is especially with kids, is they first go, oh, I can't go to space, and then they get sad. And then they turn to you and ask you like 10 questions they've been storing up for, you know, their entire lives, even if they're only four. And suddenly they want to know about everything about space. So they kind of have a moment when they think, okay, this isn't real, I can't go to space yet. And then, hold on, I can ask you about all the things that I don't know about. And that's really fun because they get super excited. And then by the time they're sending postcards, they want to send like 10.
This is not for real, right? This is for fun.
Well, we can talk later about the feasibility of these options for you. But I do have to warn you, by law, we do have a 50% fatality rate for those that sail the solar wind, and that's due...
Count me out!
I'm going to turn the tables on you. I got $6 billion. What do you do next?
So you got $6
billion? Yeah.
I'm going to say...
Checks on the table.
I'm going to say, the solar system, let's get way past that. Let's just take you out. We'll take you, you know, past the solar system. We'll take you to another galaxy. And that way you can be part of our new colony. unfortunately, we're going to have to wait a little bit for technology. But if you've been watching Star Trek, we all know that life imitates art, so that should be fine. And we just have to, you have to give me $6 billion and a little bit of interest and maybe three or four years, and I'll sort it out.
We did have one man that did seem somewhat interested in the zero-G flight on what's colloquially called the Vomit Comet, which takes parabolic trips up and down and lets people experience weightlessness. So that costs $5,000.
For your $5,000, we can show you space. I can talk to you about the end of the universe. You know, that $5,000 given cosmic time is really nothing.
Come learn about space at the Intergalactic Travel Bureau. Interested in a trip to Mars? Take a trip to the moon.
Scientists with a taste for theater, Olivia Kosky, Dr. Jana Gersovich, and Dr. Renee Lozek at the Intergalactic Travel Bureau in Midtown Manhattan. Where in space would you go if you could? Francesa writes on Facebook, Risa, where Star Trek personnel vacation, or that planet where Kirk and McCoy take shore leave, and anything they desire indeed comes true. From Lubbock, Texas, I would go to the middle of a nebula, maybe Orion, to watch stars being born, like that one. Listener in Allentown, New York writes, Mars, to see if the characters in a story I wrote in seventh grade were real after all. Pick your place, real or fictional, by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Head for the stars. But next week, we're going to be running a series on the experience of caregivers across America. We want to peek into the lives of folks who care for an injured veteran, a disabled loved one, an aging someone in the aging population, someone with dementia or Alzheimer's. There are huge numbers of people doing this. You know who you are. The trials of watching over an adult child with autism.
It's a real dilemma because his caregiving is really a full-time job, you know, and he's 24 years old. And I don't see an end in sight to that. So I feel, you know, exhausted and powerless. Feels like I've been waging a war for 20 years.
You'll hear more voices like that of our friend Linda. You're a caregiver out there. We want to know next week, how you doing? How's it going? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway using the hashtag #ICareFor. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.